Wow, this is a great turnout. This is fantastic. So now, Alpha Omega Fresno meets Alpha Omega Merced. That's great. Glad you all made it. All right. Let me see. Good. So anyway, as Zane said, I'm John Oakes. I've been chemistry and physics professor about 35 years. Let me tell you a little bit about myself, and I'll introduce the topic. So I was raised going to church. It was like a Protestant denomination, a fairly liberal Protestant denomination. But, you know, I went to church, and I was the president of the youth group, and I was the guy who carried the cross around. But I was also a knucklehead, doing knucklehead things that knucklehead people do in high school. Plus, I didn't believe in God. So that was a problem. How I could be the president of the church youth group when I didn't believe in God, I guess it didn't matter at that church. But anyway, so I went off to college and I continued my knucklehead ways. And it was the early 70s. You can fill in the blank on that. You can probably imagine. But actually during my sophomore or junior year in college, I came to realize through studying chemistry and physics, wow, there's an actual God. And then I decided I probably should kind of deal with that God. So I started a sort of a spiritual journey. Actually, I was originally attracted to Eastern religion. You know, cause in pantheism, you're told that you are God. And that's kind of a nice thought. It turns out that I'm actually not God. I found that out later on. All right. But then, in 1978, December 13th, 1978, I became a Christian and I've been hanging in there since then. 38 years of marriage to this wonderful woman back here. Three kids, all older than everybody in the room except for Jan and Michael, I guess. All right, great. So, anyway, my topic is God and science. We're going to have a question and answer session at the end. It'll just be, you know, raise your hand or whatever. So if something comes up, be prepared to ask a question at the end. I'm going to go for about 45 minutes, and then we'll have maybe as much time for Q&A as you like. Okay, great. So, God and science. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at two possible views of reality, of physical reality. One would be the naturalist's view or the atheist view. I'll let that be represented by Thomas Huxley, a good friend of Charles Darwin. And Huxley said, "We are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth or the ebb and flow of the tides. We just happened. And man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents." Notice he says, man was made flesh. He's purposely sort of alluding to the Bible there. All right, so this is one explanation of reality. And the good question is this one true? Does it work? Does it make sense? I could take a more modern expression of the same idea. It comes from good old Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion. He said, "In the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky, and they won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. It just is, and we dance to its music." And the question is that a rational description of reality? One thing I know is it's depressing, but if it's true, you know, buck up. That's just the way it is. All right. So I want to consider another possibility that actually nature is consistent with the idea of design and therefore a designer. All right. So there's the good old watchmaker argument, but instead of the watchmaker argument, I'm going to use the cell phone argument and I'm going to take Joshua's cell phone here. All right. Now let's just imagine. All right, let's just imagine you're walking down the street and you see that thing on the street. You're thinking, how did that get there? I don't know, maybe a series of singularly beneficial accidents. You know, a little metal, some plastic, some silicon, and you know, a few other elements, and you know, the kicked some weather, some rain, and a car, boom, pocket watch, boom, cell phone. What do you think about that? That is ridiculous. In fact, if you believe that, you would be possibly crazy. My question is, which has more complexity, more evidence of design, the pocket watch, or, sorry, that was Paley's argument, All right, they didn't have cell phones back in 1796 or whatever, but or the simplest living thing, like a bacteria, which is a nanofactory of unimaginable complexity. And yet there are people that believe that life came about by a series of singularly beneficial accidents. In fact, I would say life coming from just random collisions of molecules, a little bit more like a tornado going through a junkyard. And all the wood and the glass and the paper and the metal and the garbage thrown up in the air. And out comes the 747. And by the way, it's a very sad day for the 747 because as I believe yesterday or the day before, they officially said no more 747s. You all don't care about that.
No.
But us old people, it's like, aww. Yeah. All right, there's a name for this. It's called the anthropic principle. And the simple question is why? And can the naturalist, can the atheist answer the question, why? Why does anything exist? The anthropic principle says the reason anything exists at all, in fact, the reason the universe has the properties it has is so that we could be here and experience it. By the way, that's not a scientific explanation. It's a philosophical explanation. But the question is it consistent with the reality? So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend the next about 25 minutes or so. I've taught introductory physics and chemistry for many, many years. So I'm just going to draw material from the basic courses I've taught dozens of times and see evidence that I believe makes the first view nonsense and the second view the only one that works at all. All right, so let's talk about good old water. Now, hopefully, for the students at UC Merced, seeing HOH, you didn't really need this label here. That was unnecessary. All right. Not enough people are laughing. That's because we have a bunch of CSE majors over here, and they don't know what the water molecule is. Okay, anyway. Yeah. All right. Anyway, you could teach an entire one-semester course simply to describe and explain the properties that are unique to water. All right. In other words, water has a long list of properties, which is the only molecule that has that property. And every single one of those properties, if water didn't have that property, there'd be no life. And the question is that just an accident? All right. For example, in order for life to exist, you have to have a liquid. You can't have life in a gas or a solid. It doesn't make any sense. It's got to be a liquid. But it would have to be a liquid in a fairly narrow range between about minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Below that, not enough energy to support, chemical reactions happening. Above that, molecules fall apart. And it just so happens that water is liquid across almost that entire range, but actually it's beneficial to us that it's frozen in the bottom part of that range, as I'll explain in a little bit. All right, not only that, but this liquid has to be able to dissolve a wide range of molecules. Specifically, it absolutely has to dissolve ionic substances. Otherwise, you couldn't have, let's say, a nervous system. Guess how many molecules are liquid between minus 20 and 80 that also dissolve ionic substances? Only one. Water, the only one. Not only that, but water dissolves a wide range of organic molecules as well. In fact, water absorbs a wider range of molecules than any other substance, but luckily it doesn't dissolve everything, otherwise I'd be a puddle right now, which would be a little bit problematic. All right, another thing about water is that it has a very high specific heat. That means its ability to absorb water. Now, would you rather live in California near the coast or 150 miles inland? Well, that's an easy question. Why? Because water has a very high specific heat. In fact, water has a specific heat roughly 10 times that of most substances and more than double all other substances. So, well, if it weren't for that, then the temperature in the Earth would go up and down by, say, 200 degrees centigrade in any given year, which would be really, really problematic. Okay, but that's not the only thing. Now, as you probably knew, for water, the solid floats on the liquid, right? You knew that already. Guess how many compounds, there are millions of compounds, guess how many compounds have the solid floating on the liquid? Only one, only water. No, so what? By the way, there's one element. I think it's antimony. It's weird, antimony. That's an element. It's not a molecule. So why is that important? Because in the winter, I know that they don't really have actual winter here, but, imagine if we did. In the winter, what happens is the lighter ice floats on top of the heavier water. Ice is a poor conductor of heat. Water is an excellent conductor of heat. Otherwise, in the winter, lakes would freeze to the bottom, which would be a little bit problematic. But during ice ages, the oceans would freeze to the bottom. Life would disappear. Now, water is this another really weird property. Every substance in the universe has density versus temperature that goes like this. Guess how many exceptions there are? Only one. Water, its density goes like this, actually goes like that, except below 4 degrees centigrade, it goes back the other direction. So in the winter, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. All right. And there are other properties of water, its viscosity, et cetera, all of which are designed for life to exist. Now, I would say to the atheist, what do you say about this? I mean, luck, accident, and does that even make sense? All right, now some people are probably breaking out in sweats right now, getting hives, there you go. Now, I tell my students that this chart here was invented by Mendeleev, the Russian chemist. And by the way, about 4 years ago, I was in Kiev, and I got to actually lecture in his lecture hall there in Kiev, which is kind of cool. But anyway, it's not Mendeleev, I believe, anyway, who invented this chart. By the way, there's about 100 naturally occurring elements, like 92 or so. And a good question for Dave is why are there so many elements? They say, well, because of the electronic structure. Okay, well, why is there that electronic structure? Seriously, why are there so many elements? And there are at least 22 elements. I'm sure there's more than that. There are at least 22 elements that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, there'd be no life. Coincidence or design, you decide. But to me, it's fairly obvious. All right, which element am I going to start with? Anybody has a little chemistry background? The most obvious element to talk about unique properties that are important to life. Carbon. Very good. Start with carbon. Now, carbon is the only element that forms molecules with four bonds. Actually, that's not completely true because silicon also does. But with silicon, if you connect two silicon atoms together, that molecule explodes, which is kind of problematic for life, okay? So why do you need to have four bonds? Well, the reason you need to have four bonds is if you have one bond, it's linear. If you have two bonds, it's bent. Three bonds, it's planar. But in order to have a three-dimensional molecule, you have to have four bonds. And if you didn't have four bonds, then you wouldn't have three-dimensional molecules, and then you wouldn't have three-dimensional living things, which seems to be fairly important. Okay, that's not the only... I love teaching organic chemistry because the first two lectures when I teach organic chemistry are all the properties unique to carbon, all of which... without which there would be no life. And it's kind of cool because my students kind of figure out that I'm a believer after a while. No, I don't invite them all to church and stuff like that, but there you go. So another property that carbon has is it's the only element that forms large molecules. Well, that's kind of important. If you can form large molecules, you certainly couldn't have living things. In fact, it's funny, in chemistry, we have a two-semester course for carbon, then we have a one-semester course for all the other elements. There's a reason for that. And by the way, we can talk about it forming single, double, and triple bonds and rings and all that other stuff that I say in organic class that I'm not going to get into right now. All right, there are some other elements that have properties that are necessary for life. One of them is iron, good gold iron. Okay, iron has a property that only iron has, which is that it forms a strong magnetic field. All right, and why is that important? Well, you know, how else would your parents have put your homework on the refrigerator? No, that's the joke. All right. No, actually, because the Earth requires a magnetic field. Actually, there are two kinds of radiation that are produced by the sun. By the way, roughly 80% of the energy from the sun is visible light. Perfect, because that's the only kind of light energy that can cause chemical reactions without destroying molecules. Lower energy doesn't cause reactions. Higher energy blows up molecules. But there are two kinds of energy that come from the sun, which would destroy all life, and God created two different elements, one to deal with each of those kinds of energy, which is so cool. So there's that solar wind, the high energy particles, protons and electrons, and it turns out the magnetic field of the Earth is literally a force field. That's so cool. But it requires two coincidences, because it turns out the nucleus of iron is the most stable nucleus of all the nuclei. All right, why is that important? Well, let's say you had this wonderful magnetic element and it's 0.02% of the Earth's content. Actually, the Earth is made up out of mainly iron. All right, so it just so happens the only strong magnetic field element is also the most stable element. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Okay, and my question is this just an accident? Just so happens to have this one element? I say, if you think so, that's bordering on not even being a rational approach to the information. Okay, we could talk about oxygen. The cool thing is oxygen comes in two forms, O2, which is the form of oxygen, which is the only element that allows to sustain high metabolism life. All right, but there's another form of oxygen, O3, ozone, which is very, very poisonous and would kill us all, except for the fact that most of the ozone is in the upper atmosphere, absorbing the ultraviolet radiation. Otherwise, we'd have some major problems. We could talk about hydrogen. We could talk about so many other elements that have unique properties. Let's just do uranium as our last one. Uranium, probably you're aware that it's dangerous, right? It's radioactive. Actually, believe it or not, uranium is not all that radioactive. I don't know if you knew that. The reason it's not very radioactive is because it has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Now, I'm not suggesting that you have chunks of uranium sitting around your room there. All right, and lucky for us, though, because if it were not for uranium, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, which happens to be roughly the age of the Earth, if it weren't for that, then the Earth would be cold and solid all the way to the middle. You say, wouldn't that be a good thing? Then we'd have no more volcanoes. Right. But if it weren't for plate tectonics, because plate tectonics is this massive recycling system that recycles the minerals in the Earth. Otherwise, the surface of the Earth would be virtually sterile. Also, another important thing about plate tectonics is it basically gives us an atmosphere. So if you want to go to a planet that has no plate tectonics, that's great. There's very little uranium in Mars. There's also very little atmosphere and very sterile soil. So again, thank you, God, for designing uranium to have a long enough half-life to produce enough energy. Otherwise, we'd be out of luck. So that's chemistry. Now let's do a little biochemistry. I love teaching biochemistry because so many things come up. Almost every week, something comes up. You kind of go, wow, that's amazing. Phew. Well, let's talk about DNA for a while. All right, you all know about DNA, C, G, A, and T. Okay, got it? And so you've got your nucleotides, and it just so happens that three nucleotides, each set of three, forms a code to choose an amino acid to create a protein. Now, I've got a question, because let's go back to our friend here. What did he say? A series of singularly beneficial accidents. Is it possible that amino acids just randomly bumping into each other, or nucleotides just randomly bumping into each other could create a code through random events? Could random events produce a code? The answer is, of course it couldn't. But there's people that believe that it could. It's called atheists. Well, why do they believe that? Well, I believe there's a circular reasoning going on here. They know it's true. How do you know it's true? Because it's true. Well, that's not a very good reason to think that it's true. All right, anyway, going back to DNA here. Let's find our DNA. There you go. So, and we're talking about a lot of information. Now, nature creates order spontaneously. Let me see. Here's an example. Nature creates order spontaneously. But what nature never does is create information spontaneously. There's a thing called the second law of thermodynamics that says that doesn't happen. We're talking about a lot of information. In the case of human genome, 3 billion base pairs. But for the simplest life, because evolution is a thing, it's an actual thing. Yeah, I know some Christians don't think so, but they probably should change their mind about that. It's an actual thing. All right, and so let's talk about a bacteria, a simple bacteria, E. coli bacteria, 100 million base pairs. All right, let's cut that, 50 million base pairs. So think about this. The probability of random association of nucleotides coming together to produce that much information would be like taking 50 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they land, you could read it in Swahili or whatever language you choose. Is that possible? The answer is no, actually, based on the mathematical definition of zero. No, that's not possible. That would not, could not happen. That's the amount of information in several novels. Okay, and then there's another problem with life coming just random accidents, is that the thing that DNA does, as I assume you knew already, is it makes proteins. So DNA makes proteins, but proteins make DNA. So my question to the atheist is, which came first? The proteins or the DNA? Because this original living thing, in its little sac that just happened to come together to make the cell, it had the DNA that would have made the proteins, but it didn't. And it had the proteins that would have made the DNA, but they didn't. Talk about the chicken and the egg. Now, they came up with the RNA world. In fact, a guy who invented the whole RNA world idea was, I know the guy, he got the Nobel Prize. But trust me, RNA does not do the job for reasons, technical reasons I won't go into here. All right, so, yes. Yeah, let's imagine by some incredible stroke of luck, a single protein molecule was made by random collisions. The same energy that resulted in the production of that molecule would almost immediately destroy that molecule. Alright, you know, imagine taking a vacuum cleaner, turning it backwards, going to a pile of cards and creating a house of cards just by that. That wouldn't, because the same thing that built the house of cards would destroy it instantaneously. Crazy stuff. Alright, we did a little bit of chemistry, a little bit of biochemistry. Not much, but you know, you get the idea. Let's do a little bit of physics here. Alright, any physics fans amongst us here? Now, before, yes! Good. Oh, alright, you got two physics fans. Three physics fans. Alright, great. Alright, now before the 1940s, physicists and cosmologists were unanimous on this one point. The universe was eternal. Okay, why did they think the universe was eternal? Was it because of scientific evidence for that? No, that's not why. It was for philosophical reasons. Because if the universe is not eternal, then it was created. And if it was created, that creates problems, not for all scientists, just for that chunk of scientists that are atheists. That's a problem for them. So they stuck with the eternal universe idea. But then I think probably some of you know that in the 1930s, the redshift was discovered, which shows the universe is expanding very, very rapidly, which led to the idea of the Big Bang model. And then in the early 1960s, they discovered the cosmic microwave background radiation and some other element distribution, all that technical stuff. Bottom line is, by about the 1960s, scientists had changed their mind. And they've decided now that the universe was created, something from nothing. There was nothing. And then in one instant of creation, a brilliant, massive flash of light, all the energy, mass, space itself, even time. Before this event, there was not even time, never mind space or matter. But the Bible kind of was saying that all along, Hebrews 11:3, by faith we know that the things that are seen were created from something that is unseen. So physics caught up with the Bible at that point. So you got the red shift and the background radiation and all that kind of stuff. So now physicists have caught up with the Bible on this, which is the universe was created. In fact, Christianity predicts the universe should be created. It should follow universal, unchanging laws that are mathematical in form and understandable by human beings. Check, check, check. All right, but then as physicists began to study this apparent event, by the way, you can't prove that the Big Bang happened. All you can say is all the evidence is consistent with this model and this explanation, so it's reasonable to think that it did. And it's kind of almost not reasonable to think that it didn't to some extent, but whatever. So what they began to notice is there's what they call fine-tuning in the universe. In other words, certain parameters that have to exist, otherwise you don't have a universe, are tuned to a precision of incredible amount of precision. For example, let's talk about the force of gravity. Now, would you agree that that's a small number?
Yeah.
Okay. Turns out, to the atheist, Why is there gravity? Because of gravitons. Well, why are there gravitons? You know, at some point, the atheist goes, there just is. Well, that's not a very good explanation. But then the next question would be, why is gravity so finely tuned? Because it turns out what they discovered is if the force of gravity was bigger by that fraction from what it actually is, the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it was created. But on the other hand, if the force of gravity was smaller than it is by the same fraction, then matter would have never clumped and formed galaxies and stars and planets. So let's just imagine you're making a random universe. What's the probability of having the universe have the right force of gravity? Well, there you go. It's right there. All right, so let's imagine you had a friend, and they were playing the big lotto, okay? They're playing the big lotto, and they won. What would be your response? Yeah! Yeah! Wait a minute, you're a Christian. Christians aren't supposed to gamble. Oh, whatever.
Yeah,
all right,
that.
Let's imagine that person won again the next week.
Wow, we won again.
You know, you remember the movie Slumdog Millionaire, that sort of scenario. Well, the probability of having the right force of gravity just in a random universe is the equivalent of winning the big lotto 6 times in a row. Alright, and I don't think so. I'd say this is roughly the probability that the atheist is right and there is no God. Oh, but that's ignoring all the other parameters. Some of which are fine-tuned to plus or minus 30%, others to one part in 10 to the 30th. This is just a sample. What about the nuclear strong force? Alright, that's what holds the protons and neutrons together. Okay, got it? Well, if it was just a little bit bigger, then there'd be no hydrogen. No hydrogen, no stars, no life. If it was just a few percent smaller, there'd be only hydrogen. That'd also be problematic. So why does the nuclear strong force have the size that it has? And there's something like 30-something parameters, all of which have to simultaneously have this very precise value. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. And at some point, naturalism or materialism or determinism, whatever you want to call this philosophy, becomes an irrational perspective, in my opinion. And again, by the way, when I first came to believe in God, I didn't know all this stuff. It was pretty basic stuff. It was like, wow, there's definitely a God there. All right, Fred Hoyle said a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as chemistry and biology. Anthony Flew, the most famous atheist in the second half of the 20th century, kind of finally came around in 2002, I think. All right, we could talk about other evidence for design, but I want to get to part 2 of my talk. But my conclusion is that Romans 1:20 rings true. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that scientists are like totally without excuse. You know, I hang out with scientists, you know what I'm saying? And by the way, some people think almost scientists are atheists, and that's not true. It's just that the atheist scientists are the loud ones. That's the problem. And I think the believers should get a little bit louder. All right, so next I want to talk about science in the Bible just a little bit. All right, and I'll just share a story related to the whole, you know, loudness of the atheists among scientists. I was in a van, this is, I don't know, quite a few years ago, like 20 years ago, with 8 or 10 science professors. We were going between venues, and this one woman said, Christianity, what a stupid religion. She said, did you know that in the Bible it says that if somebody wears clothing with more than one material, capital punishment? How stupid is that? And I said, excuse me, but the Bible doesn't say that. She said, yes, it does. I saw it at a website. Okay, guess where she didn't see it?
In the Bible.
So, again, eight scientists, I pulled my Bible out, and I said a quick prayer, because I knew it was in Leviticus, I don't know, somewhere around chapter 17. I knew it was on the right-hand side, halfway down in my Bible. I found it, and I read that verse. All right. And by the way, it does prohibit the wearing of two material, which is something about purity. There's the spiritual meaning. The Jews got it. They understood it wasn't that. It was the meaning of it. But that's beside the point. And I said, you know, people say the Bible's full of all kinds of science errors. I said, I've read it through several times. I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about. It got really quiet. It got really quiet in that van. The thing is, if there are eight scientists in that van, probably two or three or four of them were believers. And I was the only one who spoke up. All right, so here's Dulles McCown, a biologist and atheist. He says Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable. That's the common assumption. Only an idiot. I mean, sure, you know, you're uneducated people, but clearly a scientist wouldn't believe this stuff, obviously. All right, philosophically suspect at best. Disreputable at worst and historically fraudulent. Let's go to that historically fraudulent. Okay, so the Bible's full of a bunch of historical lies. Do you have one? Is there a single fact in the Bible that is in conflict with what we know from history? Do you happen to have one of those? Help me out here. Philosophically suspect at best. So, okay, great. I'm going to put biblical philosophy or theology up against postmodernism and naturalism, and I propose, in fact, I'm almost done writing a book on that topic. But let's talk about science. Because what do we have from part A of this talk? We have a created universe, which is, like, really smart. So we have an incredibly powerful and incredibly smart creator. Is that creator a person? What about that creator? Could pantheism work or deism or whatever? So I'm going to make an argument for the biblical theistic God as the creator of the universe. And I'm going to talk a little bit about evidence that supports the Bible from science. Okay, got it? Now, this is Papyrus Ebers. It was recorded around 1500 BC. It's basically a compendium of medical knowledge from Egypt. Now, the timing is kind of important in a way, because 1500 BC, that's pretty close to when Moses was doing his thing. All right, and scholars, I believe medical historians will tell you that the ancients, Egyptians and Chinese, probably had more advanced medical knowledge in ancient times than other cultures. All right, but here are some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. To prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake. Clearly, I've not been using that, but I've also not been using the second formula. Here we go. The mixture of six fats, namely those of the horse, hippo, crocodile, cat, snake, and ibex, to prevent hair loss. Okay. Again, I don't think that would work, and clearly I've not been using that. But, you know, the idea of this was, I think, for the guys to look, you know, more handsome for the women, I guess. But would you hang out with somebody with that stuff on their head?
Yeah.
All right. Now, we're making a joke out of this, but honestly, this is a serious issue. For example, some of the medicines for curing infectious diseases in Papyrus Ebers included things like lizard's blood, pig teeth, rotten meat, the moisture from pig's ears, actual medicine, excrement, including, yes, even human excrement was used as medicine. You got a little thing there, you kind of rub that on there. All right, now, we're sort of chuckling. But actually, this is a tragic thing. The average lifespan was around 20. Not that people couldn't live to be 80, it's just that almost everybody died from some kind of infectious disease. And the ancients had no solution. Now, there's an interesting passage in Exodus 15:26. Read it for yourself, see if I'm taking it out of context. I don't think I am. And basically, what God says to his people is this. If you follow the commands I'm giving you today, you'll have none of the diseases of the neighboring people. He's not saying no diseases at all, but there are specific diseases that were prevented by biblical mandates, as we will see. One example would be the whole meat thing. All right, so pig unclean, weasel, rat, eagle, things like that. Clean meats included, beef, right? Definitely not pork. Shellfish, no. Fish, yes. Now, it just so happens that every meat on the do-eat list is relatively safe, And every meat on the don't eat list is relatively not safe. All right, pork has been shown to carry something like 22 different diseases, one of which is trichinosis. That's a really bad disease. Beef is relatively safe. Even raw. I was in Venezuela a few years ago with my wife Jan and ordered from a menu. I speak Spanish, but I don't. I said, bring me that one. It was a plate of raw beef. And I thought, all right, amen. Leviticus 11, went for it. Okay, raw clams, taking your life in your hands. Raw fish with scales, sushi. Now, if this was the only example in the Old Testament, I would say the skeptic might have a reasonable answer to this one thing. But I'll tell you this. All the other peoples ate all those other things, and they died in large numbers. Think about it. What cultures have been around for 4,000 years or 3,500 years? You know, we got the Indian culture, Chinese culture, Egyptian culture, and the Jews. I mean, they don't seem to fit those other groups, you know? The other groups had great places with all kinds of, you know, arable land. Why is that? Well, I would propose one reason is they just lived longer and had more children. All right, another example would be, in case you thought the Jews somehow had this inherent ability, I don't know, to be better at medicine or something like that, I don't think so. So here's a Jewish document, obviously not in the Bible, which comments, it gives medical advice. Here we go. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting. Stop right there. All right, is that true that flies don't have poop? That's not true. That's a science error. There is none, not one, none in the Bible that I know of. And, you know, I'm a scientist. It's my job to be skeptical. Anyway, going on. Is a specific against the poison of the viper. So if you get bitten by a snake, you take a fly, crush it up, and put it on there. Now, I think they had to keep a supply of flies around because if you get bitten by a snake, then you go out and catch a fly. All right. So there you go. My point there is it's not like the Jews sort of inherently just had this knowledge that nobody else did. That doesn't make sense. Here you go. Here's another one. Numbers 19. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with the water. The third and seventh day, hyssop, ash, water, sprinkle everything they touch, the furnishings, and all that sort of stuff. Now, this seems like a kind of a harsh law. Because if somebody dies, the people who help prepare the body for the funeral then cannot even attend the funeral. Why would God do something like that? Well, I want to propose because it saved a lot of lives. Because dead bodies are actually really dangerous. All right, here's Ignaz Semmelweis, a physician in Vienna in a women's hospital. And in his hospital, 19-20% of the women died in the hospital. There's a reason that back then women had their babies at home. It wasn't because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital. It's because they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital, actually. All right? And Semmelweis, this is in the 1850s, around the time that Pasteur and others were proposing what we now call germ theory. So what Semmelweis noticed is that doctors would come in the morning and you know, examine the women who died. They had what they called puerperal fever. All right, just poke around and then go upstairs, up into the wards and start examining patients. Ah! Crazy stuff. So he said, whenever you touch a dead body, clean your hands very, very thoroughly with soap and water. An obvious thing. But then he proposed, using this concept of germ theory, an interesting thing is, these commands that are in the Bible, God didn't tell them why, he just said, do it. That tells me something. Let's say you read something in the Bible you don't agree with, and you don't want to do it. Let me suggest, just do it anyway, right? Because God probably knows what he's doing. A little philosophy there. All right. So anyway, some of us, by the way, I was giving this talk in Budapest. And I said that Semmelweis was Serbian. They said, no, he's not. He's Hungarian. I said, I think he's Serbian. So they took me to his house. So that's his house. Yeah, so. I think, anyway, never mind. I was just saying I was all wrong. I was going to say I was totally wrong, but I was just wrong. All right, anyway, Semmelweis said, not only that, but whenever you touch a live patient, wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water between patients. The death rate went from 20% to 0.5%.
Wow.
Now, in the Bible, not only does it say when you touch a dead body, you're unclean, but that when women give birth or have their period, they're unclean. Why would God say that? Because everyone knows that God hates women, right? No. Because when you give birth or when you are having your monthly period, you're very susceptible to lots of different infections. Think about how many lives were saved. All right, anyway, you would think they would have a marching band and celebrate Semmelweis. He actually was fired by the hospital administration, and he died of a blood infection not too long after that. Okay, here we go. One of every six was dying. They were saying causes were constipation stuff like that. Fell from 18%. Here we go. Now, the prescription was this. Take hyssop, ashes from the red heifer sacrifice, there's the spiritual thing going on there, and then water. Well, what's the deal there? It turns out if you take hyssop, which is a very, very oily herb, and you mix that with ashes and water, you make soap. This is soap, but it's a particular kind of soap because oil of hyssop has 5% in the oil of this compound thymol. Now, when I teach organic chemistry, we call this a phenol. And when I teach about phenols in my organic chemistry class, the first property I mention of phenols is that they're antiseptics. These compounds are not poisonous for humans, but they kill bacteria. Oh. So God's prescription, when you touch a dead body, was to take a powerful antibacterial soap, wash your entire body and everything you touched, and then you're clean. Okay. Moving on. How about leprosy. Leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world, not because it killed the most people. Cholera killed more people. Malaria killed more people. But it was just the way it killed people. It's just a horrifying way to die. All right. Medical science had no answer for that. The Bible simply said if somebody gets certain skin diseases, which would include leprosy, complete, utter separation from everybody else. All right. Quarantine. And again, that's harsh. And if you had leprosy, that is harsh. And what's interesting is in the 16th century in Europe, I believe it was in Scandinavia, there were a bunch of monks in a particular order that decided to try quarantine for leprosy. And it caught on, and within two or three generations, leprosy virtually disappeared in Europe. All right, so it actually works. Okay, it actually works. Okay, two more examples. There are many. Two more examples. Leviticus 17:14, which says the life of every creature is in its blood. That is why I said to the Israelites, you must not eat the blood of any creature because the life of every creature is in its blood. Now, it's interesting. Each one of these commandments has a spiritual meaning that the Jews got, and you could see that. The life is in the blood. We Christians, yeah, the life's in the blood. Yeah, I get that one. Yeah. Okay. Now, do you know what the most common medical treatment in the 18th and 19th centuries in Western Europe was?
Bloodletting.
That's correct. And basically, the theory was that if you have a disease, the disease is in the blood, which makes sense. Not true, but it makes sense, right? Otherwise, that explains how it spreads through the body. Okay, got it. So they proposed what you do is you drain some of the blood, which is a really bad idea because we know that if you have an infectious disease, quite literally, the life is in the blood. Bad idea to be draining that blood out. Not a great idea. Okay, last one. This would be uncircumcision. Now, this is pre-Mosaic law. This goes all the way back to Genesis, 17 or 16, the time of Abraham. for the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Now, circumcision is not without some danger. Now, circumcising an infant boy is relatively low danger, but for an adult male, I've not tried it as an adult, but I'm guessing it's not much fun. All right. Now, two questions. Why circumcision? Why the eighth day? Why circumcision? Well, think about it. Like I said, almost everybody in ancient times died from some kind of infectious disease, either fungus or bacteria or virus. And those three, fungus, bacteria, and virus, they like to thrive wherever it's warm and wet and dark. Right. So where's the warmest, wettest, darkest place on a guy? Yeah. All right, that's not too hard to figure out. Okay, got it? Yeah. And think about this. It was mostly female lives that were saved, more than male lives. It was female lives that were saved. How many? How many lives were saved? In the case of AIDS, it's been shown there's about roughly a 60% reduction in the male to female spread of AIDS if there's male circumcision. In fact, in the very early 2000s, there were massive adult male circumcision campaigns in Africa. I don't know how many volunteers they got for that, but it would work. By the way, the Bible has a better way to prevent the spread of AIDS. No, it's one partner for life.
No, I mean circumcision.
Yes, okay,
that
there you
is
go.
What I mean by
yes.
That is what I mean.
Great comment, Josh, great comment. But I would say one partner for life, that's virtually a 100%. In fact, that would end the spread of AIDS, period. End of story. Okay, but why the eighth day? I don't know. God didn't say why circumcision. He didn't say why the eighth day. He just said the eighth day. But I think actually I do know, although I can't prove it, I think I do know, because it turns out that vitamin K does not pass from mother to child. It doesn't go through the placenta. If you were to circumcise that infant, it'd be a problem. Now, by the way, when children are born now in hospital, male circumcision of males, yes or no, it's not a Christian issue. It's not, it's just yes or no. That's, you know, there's good and bad about it. I'm not going to settle that question. It's not important. Okay. But the fact is that when babies are born, they give them a vitamin K shot. That's just one of the very first things they do. All right. So it would not be dangerous to circumcise a male child on the first or second day. But it turns out the vitamin K does not actually produce the clot. The relevant protein is this thing called prothrombin. And it turns out vitamin K is required to make prothrombin. Now, when the baby is born, they do have some prothrombin because it does pass through the placenta, but like 50% lower than the equilibrium level. So baby is born, gets the bacteria from mommy, gets in the gut, makes vitamin K. Prothrombin level goes down because there's no vitamin K, and then it comes up. It goes up to an above average level, and then it settles down to an equilibrium level. I'm going to show you a graph. This is scientific data showing the level of prothrombin in the male infant versus time. Okay, look at that graph. Okay. By the way, day 7 or day 9, there's a fair amount of uncertainty in this data. Day 7 and day 9 probably statistically are just as good. And again, why the eighth day? You know, for Jews, maybe the 12th day or the third day. Those numbers. Why eight? What's the spiritual meaning of the number eight? That's interesting. All right. So my conclusion is. Oh yeah. By the way, this is how they figured it out. They did a double blind experiment. This is a joke. This is not what actually they did. All right. So, you know. Yeah. No, that's not how they figured it out. All right. I don't think so. Okay. So, now, I'm trying to use sort of scientific stuff in the Bible as evidence for the Bible being inspired. The reason I did that is because this is science and God, and I was trying to at least demonstrate on some level, which God, part one, well, part two, I propose maybe the one that's in the Bible. But I'm telling you, I don't believe the Bible is inspired primarily from the scientific evidence. I mean, let's say here's all the evidence that the Bible's inspired by God. And of that, like this much is science and there's all the other stuff, you know, fulfilled prophecies and all that other stuff. All right. So, in fact, 2 Timothy 3:16 says all scripture is inspired by God. I don't know how many times I've studied the Bible with people and asked them, do you believe all scripture is inspired by God? And they typically say yes. And then I ask them, well, why do you believe that? Because it says that in 2 Timothy 3:16. That's the worst argument ever made. Talk about circular reasoning. Anyway, so that's my talk. And I think I finished, yeah, pretty much within the time I said. So we'll have as much question and answer time as you like. So, anybody? Yeah.
I had more of a philosophical question than scientific. You talked about in your younger days, you studied Eastern religion. Uh-huh. I have a friend who studied Eastern religion quite thoroughly as well. He's caught up in that whole, oh, well, why can't we be God? And stuff.
Yeah.
I wanted to know if you have any apologetics.
Sure. Like I said, it just so happens, I'm writing book number 16 right now, and that is the topic. All right, that it's a worldview book. But I would say, if pantheism is true, that means God and the universe are the same thing. Well, if that were true, then the universe has to be eternal. But it's not. So pantheism is not true. All right? It's just not true. And we could talk about the title of my book is True, Right, Better. It's not true, it's not right, and it's not better. And we can go into that because some of the philosophical implications of Eastern religion are basically dispassion rather than compassion. That's a problem for me. But the bottom line is Eastern cosmology is wrong. And any Eastern religion person who sort of tries to get around that, they end up in a corner. Because the universe cannot create itself. That's craziness. That's insanity. And that's, Eastern religion is monism. The idea that everything is one. Everything is one thing. Alright? And, that's not true. So that'd be my first response. I'd say that respectfully. And again, I was going that way. I was into Paramahansa Yogananda and all this sort of stuff, and kind of the power trip with Don Juan Yaqui Way of Knowledge, and I did some substances that were kind of along those lines. But right, so I would say if I talk about atheism, postmodernism, pantheism, animism, polytheism, deism, all of those worldviews are false for various reasons. In fact, we can talk about Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is a worldview argument. Alright? But that doesn't prove it's true. You ask me why. Genesis 1 is not proof of anything, but it is a worldview argument. For example, it says in the beginning. Well, there you go. That's a cosmological statement, either true or false. In the beginning, God. Okay, that makes sense. In the beginning, God created. And so all of those are knocking down other worldviews. Again, that's not proof against them. I'm just saying they can't both be true. So if the pantheist is right, then Jesus was a liar. Yeah.
My personal response to your question would be this. What can multiple all-powerful gods do that one alone can't? That's the question I would sarcastically ask anyone who would believe in becoming an all-powerful god.
Yeah. Now, it turns out Hinduism is complicated because most people who accept a Hindu view in America, they throw out all that polytheism and they'll go for a fairly basic pantheism of the Vedas and the Upanishads. Now, Hinduism as practiced in India is highly polytheistic. Right? So I have a feeling your American pantheist is going to say that's not what I believe. However, I'm telling you, if you go to India, there's hundreds and thousands of gods. And so the Indian version of the religion we call Hinduism, that's a proper response. Okay, any other questions? It could be along the lines of our lecture or whatever. I've answered over 3,000 questions on our website, so yeah.
Yeah, what kind of got you engaged in this debate? You seem to be very passionate about destroying the argumentation from the opposite side. Where do you see that? Kind of, how did you get started?
Well, you know, I became a Christian. I was in graduate school. I was in a chemical physics degree program, and I was kind of like the smart guy, you know. So people just naturally started asking me questions, so I naturally started doing research. Honestly, I'm more passionate about teaching the book of Romans or Hebrews or the Bible or Christian theology than this topic, honestly. But I am a scientist, so you know this is kind of my area, and I've spent years and years and years. I've written a book, Is There a God, kind of going over this. So I have a guy who's a mentor. His name is John Clayton. This is a great story, John Clayton. So he was raised by two ardent, like intense atheist parents. They were both philosophers at Columbia University. And, like, real in-your-face atheist. And so he actually was an atheist, died in the wool atheist, and he was working for Madeleine O'Hare. You probably don't know who she was. Our generation knows who she was. She was the leading atheist in America. And he was working for her, and he was the president of the Indiana Atheist Society. And he started writing a book. The title was The Bible, a book written by ignorant people in an ignorant age. And in doing his research, he became a Christian. And so he's been a mentor for me. So having a guy who's been doing it already, that kind of inspired me. Because, by the way, I would say most people don't become a Christian because of science kind of arguments. It's somewhat rare. Francis Collins is one, by the way. Francis Collins is a mere Christianity conversion. But I've seen people become Christians. I was sharing just a couple days ago, the very first time I gave this talk was at UCSD like a zillion years ago, 30 years ago. And then 27 years later, I was in Hong Kong. This guy walks up to me. He said, you know, I was an atheist, but I went to that talk at UCSD 27 years ago. You never met me, but it got me thinking. And then I asked the people there to study the Bible, and I've been a Christian for 27 years. Thank you very much. So even though it's a relatively small percentage that are converted to Christ because of scientific, logical, sort of philosophical arguments, there's some. So, you know, keep at it. Really, it's more for supporting the faith of people who already believe, honestly. All right, great. Any other questions? Yeah.
I guess for me, obviously you can have debates with like, some people just want to argue about this. How do you get them to start thinking about this side of, like, the prophecies instead of just focusing on the science?
I try to let people lead the discussion where they want it to go. I don't have a really great answer for that, honestly. You could ask them to read the Bible if they claim to be open-minded. You kind of stumped me on that. I don't have a great answer for that question. I just say, keep chipping away. Because generally, people are going to notice your life. People think that they believe things for rational reasons, but honestly, generally, it's an emotional thing that's going on there. Jeremiah 17, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately corrupt. And a lot of what we believe for emotional reasons. And so, let's see, Gulliver's Travels. Jonathan Swift, he said, you can't reason somebody out of a belief they were not reasoned into. All right, and so I think we have to let our lives speak for itself. Or you could, this might work because the Word of God creates faith, is just beg them, ask them, plead with them, bribe them, read their book. I'll read your book if you'll read my book. Okay? Yeah. And I think we should understand other people's worldviews better than they understand it themselves. I would use Acts 17 as a sort of paradigmatic example of that, where Paul could quote the Stoic philosophers, he could quote the Epicurean philosophers. I think he probably understood Stoicism and Epicureanism probably better than a lot of the Stoics and Epicureans in the room there in Athens. I don't have a single answer for that, honestly. There's a range of things. Yes, question. All right, how's that work? Okay. Now, one thing I want to admonish us about is I think it's good for us to know why we believe what we believe and not pretend differently from that. Okay? So there are things that I believe because the Bible says so. All right? Now, one of the reasons I believe the Bible is inspired by God is not because it says so, because that's a really terrible reason. All right, and so there are things that I believe because of the evidence. One of them is that life was created supernaturally. That's obvious. The universe was created supernaturally. That's obvious. The Bible is inspired by God. The evidence for that is totally overwhelming. All right, and I believe the resurrection of Jesus because of the evidence. Now, I believe in Adam and Eve really just for one reason, right? Because they're in the Bible. And I don't pretend differently from that, all right? I believe in Adam and Eve. Now, whether the guy was actually named Adam or that's just a metaphorical name for this guy, I'm not going to debate that one. Whether that the original one was actually literally named Eve, I'm not going to debate that. Their name doesn't matter. But I believe that human beings were created in God's image. And evolution cannot create a person in God's image. Evolution can create maybe a creature with prehensile thumbs. That's a possibility. I think evolution could even create a relatively intelligent mammal. But evolution could not create a person in the image of God. Now, but honestly, there's more than one possible explanation of what happened, and I don't know which is the correct one. Clearly there were intelligent apes, relatively intelligent apes kind of running around. There's evidence to point pretty strong in that direction. If you deny that, you might as well deny that, I don't know, there's Mars or something like that. So one possibility is God just went like that. You know, there you go. There's Adam. And then there's Eve. All right. Another possibility is God took an evolved intelligent, primate and made them into his image. I don't know. I wasn't there. It's not an essential of my faith. But one thing I would say is it's a pretty big mistake to ignore scientific evidence and pretend that it's not true. You go to that creation museum, and where is it, in Tennessee, and they have dinosaurs and people together. Come on, you know. By the way, you can tell that I'm an old Earth guy, not a young Earth guy, but I'm going to defend the young Earth position. I'm going to defend it. And I taught an intro to scientific thought for many, many years at Grosse Pointe College, and I gave a defense of the young Earth position. The reason I did that is some of my students were young Earthers. East County, San Diego, you got those people, and we love them. So I'm going to defend the young Earth position. I set up the stage. I'd be over here. I'd say, okay, I want to talk about this whole young Earth thing, all right? So what I'm going to do is, right now I'm here as a science professor, but I'm going to go over there and I'm going to speak theologically for a moment, okay? All right, so I said, so let's just assume for the sake of argument, whatever you believe, don't worry about that, just for the sake of argument, let's assume that there exists an all-powerful, omniscient, omnipotent God. Okay, could that God create the universe with an appearance of age? By definition. So the question is not whether he could, but the question is whether he did. So I just defended the young Earth position. All right, I say, okay, I got that. But if that's true, well, what about a galaxy that's a billion light years away? So light is hitting it's going through the telescope, hitting my eye. And it's, so when did that light leave that galaxy? If it's a billion light years away, a billion years ago. So my question is, wait a minute, does that galaxy even exist? So your proposal of God creating the universe with an appearance of age, it creates some philosophical problems for me, honestly. So really, does that galaxy exist? Now, could that God create that galaxy and create light in transit, even though it didn't start in that galaxy? God can do whatever he wants. John the Baptist said that God could create children of Abraham from those stones, and I believe it. But honestly, I'm not a young earther. I don't see any reason from Genesis or anything else to accept the young earth position. All right. In fact, there were Christians. By the way, in the first few centuries, the church was divided on this, believe it or not. There were some young earthers and there were some old earthers, it turns out. All right. Anyway. Okay.
I was wanting to talk about young earth versus old earth.
Yeah.
I think it goes against the idea, the nature and personality of God to assume that the earth must be young. God is a creator first. And
yeah.
A father to us second. And it's in his nature to desire to create. Because that's very obvious from the fact that we exist in the first place.
Right. Yeah. I'm gonna be the young earther, though. I say, exactly, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you very much for proving me right.
He would only create a universe and then immediately interpose something
right.
That looks like him into the universe.
Yeah.
Goes against the idea that he would just create just because he could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why not?
No. Okay. I'm not disagreeing with your argument there. I'm just thinking the young earther possibly may not be completely convinced by that, but maybe they would. Honestly, I don't care. I really don't care how old anybody thinks the earth is.
Yeah.
What I do care about is that they deal with scientific evidence in a reasonable way and not make Christianity look stupid.
Yeah.
In other words, those who say not only is the earth young, but science supports that conclusion. That is not true. That is not true. All right. So I could give a theological defense of the young earth, but not a scientific one.
Absolutely.
All right. Anyone else have a question?
I do, but
I wanted to know the postmodernist aspects of current philosophy you're going to talk about. Postmodernism is one of those things.
All right, postmodernism is not a bad thing. Put it this way. If I had to choose between modernist philosophy and postmodernist philosophy, I'd probably choose postmodernist philosophy, although it sucks. Modernist philosophy, I would argue, was even worse, which is basically, it's basically using human reason to explain everything. All right. And so, there's no better philosophy of human. Well, I guess there's some that are worse, whatever. So postmodernism, has been a blessing to the world in certain ways. For example, postmodernism has basically said that Western ideas are not the only possible good ones. Postmodernism, I think, has produced a more realistic understanding of history, of culture. I like what postmodernism has done for music, for art. That's fine. You don't have to. Fine, whatever. But I would say, as a worldview, it's completely incoherent, and it's certainly confusing. All right, but I'm a modernist. I can't help it. That's what I was born as. You all, even if you're Christians, I'm sorry, you're postmodern. You swim in a, So to some extent, we have to learn how to swim against our own school of thinking. And for me, honestly, postmodernism's actually helped me put behind some of the negative aspects of the philosophy I grew up with. So a lot of people, all they can say, postmodernism is from Satan. Well, no, postmodernism from human beings, and therefore it's very, very flawed. It's highly problematic. The postmodern mind tends to deny the idea of fundamental true things, and therefore doctrinal things in Christianity are suppressed, and that's a problem. But on the other hand, the modernist is totally caught up in doctrine, and they don't see the some of the communal aspects of Christianity. They tend to, my modernism is so individualistic, it makes me sick, you know what I'm saying? So there's no better one, or maybe slightly better, slightly worse. Postmodernism is particularly problematic when it comes to the idea of moral truth and truth in general. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, kind of along those lines, right? The juxtaposition between modernism, where you have the hard edges of modernism and the loose ends of postmodernism. It's kind of like, you know, you throw a splotch of paint on the board and it's art, you know.
So you're not a big postmodernist then. Actually, that's modernist art.
I'm not trying to say anything about myself, right?
Yeah.
I'm just kind of, this is what postmodernists put off. It's like, you know, it's whatever it is, it's your truth, that kind of idea.
Right.
But from a, like, kind of taking that perspective and bringing it to science, right? You can't approach science that way.
Okay.
So what do you believe God thinks science is?
God, I mean, by the way, postmodernism has influenced science in positive ways. The whole idea of scientific paradigms, which didn't make any sense. The Baconian idea that you just do experiments and the pattern shows itself, and then the theory is created from that pattern. Scientists have discovered, historians of science have discovered, that's just not how science works. I went on my own tangent. I went away from your question. How does God feel about postmodernism?
Science.
Oh, science, yeah. Well, put it this way. So science is by far the superior means devised by human beings to find answers to questions of why in the physical world. It works really, really well. So if we're talking about natural laws, science is great. Science answers questions like when, where, how many, by what means. I believe science is probably the greatest means ever discovered by human beings to answer those questions. What it doesn't answer questions is things like, what's my purpose? What's my value? What's the right thing to do? Those are the questions we really care about. Alright, and by the way, it just so happens, it's not an accident that science was created by Christians. It's not an accident. We can talk about Roger Bacon, a 13th century, who proposed, based on theology, that there should be a single set of laws governing the entire universe, unchanging, because there's a single God, also unchanging. He proposed that those laws should be understandable by human beings because of, you know, Romans 1:20, and he proposed that it should be mathematical. None of which were expected by virtually anybody before that. So there's no conflict between science and God. And I don't know. I'm guessing that God's happy that less people are dying from all these diseases and that science has helped us. But on the other hand, you know, science also allowed us to make nuclear bombs. Yeah,
again, kind of going back to what we talked about yesterday, you can't judge something by its abuse.
Right. That's true.
Where do you believe science is going, given that we are going together towards...
Well, science will continue to give us a more and more precise understanding of how the physical world works. Science will continue to allow us to produce new technologies. Whether that makes people better or not, I don't think it does.
Sure.
It does allow more people to be alive. It allows more people to live comfortable lives, but it's also going to destroy them. So, science is what it is.
Do you think that science is one of the most important things in the sense of fulfilling Isaiah 65? We have people living like way past 100, and if you don't live past 100,
I do not think that's a reference to science. I don't believe that. Because that's a kingdom prophecy.
Right.
And kingdom prophecies should be taken for what they're worth. Because again, if we have kingdom prophecies in the Old Testament, they describe this perfect world, but it's primarily a perfect world where you have, children, you know, families and seeing their grandchildren. It's describing with physical kinds of things. And yet, from a Christian perspective, the primary benefits of the kingdom of God are more in the spiritual realm. And so, I believe there's a although, I'm not saying that prophecy is not true. I think that that prophecy is primarily using a physical thing to explain something that God primarily wants us to think of as spiritual anyway.
So when God justified all of those who would become saved, and then he tells us to pray in this way, like, you know, our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, here on earth as it is in heaven.
Yeah.
Does it not behoove us, kind of like what you're doing, to evangelize and go out and use science and use speech and physical faculties for good, you know, rather than how the pagans use it for evil?
Yeah, and I would say that, unfortunately, in our culture, believers have become sort of afraid of speaking out and, you know, like speaking out in philosophy class, speaking out in sociology class. Yeah, we need believers to speak louder than they do. Because, you know, a lot of the things that our culture values, they hijack from a Christian perspective. And I think they've forgotten that. And so, yeah, I mean, we believers need to continue to influence things. One area especially I'd say is neuroscience. We really, really, really need believers to inhabit the neuroscience arena. Because neuroscience is, of all the areas of science that's dominated by determinists, it's neuroscience. Oh my goodness. And the things that neuroscience might allow us to do eventually are really scary. So we need some ethical people. We need Christians to be scientists. We need Christians to be psychologists. Whether we need Christians to be politicians, I don't know about that one. Maybe.
Hey, he put King David on the throne.
Yeah, they just stop acting like pagans. That's what he said.
All right. Anyway, I'll take one more question. We have two husband and wife. The husband's saying, he's smart. Yeah, you go. All right.
I was just going to, I guess, like, question, when it comes to, like, reading the Bible and you have things like the two creation stories that are in Genesis,
right?
Some people claim it's more poetic than actual scientific kind of reading of Scripture, and yet there is some things about that that seem to line up with science.
Right.
When do we, like, I guess, discern that, oh, this is probably just poetic versus, like, oh, maybe I should take this seriously and literally.
Right. Now you're asking a question that somebody who's been a Christian for a while is going to start asking. If you're a baby Christian, this is not a problem, all right? But somebody who's been a disciple for a while, they're going to have to ask those kind of questions. And I would say, I'm not sure, there is a right answer, but I'm not sure if I can give it to you. You have to explore for yourself. All right, but I do believe that the second creation account is things that happened on the sixth, in quotes, sixth day. I believe that there is historical content in the Genesis creation story, but I'm not going to call somebody a heretic who says it's all a worldview argument. Let's choose our issues carefully. This is something to think about because you need to be prepared to give an answer to anyone who actually gives you the reason for the hope that you have. And I'm glad you've thought about that. Please listen to people with whom you don't agree.
Yes.
All right. Be willing to read their things and consider it. But don't do just that. All right. Yeah, a little bit of balance there.
Right.
Some wise balance. But anyway, what I found is that when I listen to unbelievers, and then I think carefully over time, eventually I go, oh, wow, it increases my faith. Because something's, you know, all truth is God's truth. All right, and so, anyway, don't tell a brand new baby Christian that there's some historical and some metaphorical aspects to Genesis 1. It's going to blow their mind. They're not going to appreciate it. All right, so let's, you know, grow in our faith over time. And allow baby Christians to be baby Christians and try not to shove all this stuff down their throat too quickly. And allow, because, you know, as you grow up, you realize that everything's more complicated than you thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right? And that's just the way it is. And, you know, the Genesis creation account is a complex thing, but it is primarily a worldview theological thing. That's the main thing going on there. Yeah.
I'm someone who likes to put a bow tie on things. Like all right. A nice little package and all that. A lot from what I've heard today was science can help us understand the how, right, of a lot of things.
Right.
It doesn't really ever get to why, you know, and something like faith, God using science essentially as a tool, as much as we use it as a tool to look through the world. He, from what you described in the very beginning of Romans 1, is he's using it to get us to look back and look at him.
Right.
I was just going to ask, what is your best simplification after seeing all this, all this stuff? Is God only just trying to get us to be like, oh, that's cool, and then go on? Or what do you think God is really leading us to do once we see all this?
Well, David said, the heavens declare the glory of God. Mm-hmm. And no truer thing has ever been said. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people come to believe in God because of the heavens. And that's a good thing. I'm not sure if I completely understand your question.
Yeah. What do you think God's purpose in using something like science, but using all this? Is it just to get us to look at him?
I'm sure God, any way that you get to heaven is probably okay with God. You know what I'm saying? I would say that one tool for helping people to come to know God is to show them the wonders of nature. Absolutely. But I don't think that's the primary reason people become Christians. I think people understand that we were made in the image of God, and we just sort of inherently understand there is a purpose and meaning. People are looking for purpose and meaning. Another fundamental thing is relationships. People become Christians because of relationships, because of the need for value, purpose, fear of death. There's a whole range of things, and I don't think God is very picky about that. So, I mean, by the way, this young man is an evangelist. He's a campus minister, so you need to become as good at as many of those as you can. Okay? Very good. Thanks for coming. I did bring some books. I know students don't buy books, but I brought them in case you want to buy them. And we have the ubiquitous Costco cookies because they're the best ones.
Before you guys leave, I wanted to share some.
Shh, shh, shh.
Yeah, thank you guys. Before you guys leave, I wanted to share some announcements for those here at East Merced and Merced in general. We have a movie night tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. in Glacier 120. Where that will be decided. Sunday 10 a.m. If you need a church to come to. Come on down and worship with us at 1195 Temple Drive. That's at 10 a.m. Next week, we're going to have our devotional on Wednesdays. That's kind of like a staple thing here. Devos on Wednesdays at 7:30 p.m. in Glacier 120. We have books, as John mentioned. We also have some Nipsey response cards if you are interested in...
Do we have enough? Pass them around.
Yeah, we can. Yeah. I don't know if we do have enough, but...
Yeah, don't feel like you need to fill it out, but if you want.
We don't.
I think we know a majority of you already.
Essentially to get your contact information if you want to talk to us.
Joshua, we know already.
Yes, so for those of you interested in coming to church, we have lunch afterwards. Great meal. Yes.
Homemade cooking from Jan Oaks.
So thank you guys for attending. That was... A Super Bowl
party.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. In 10 days, we're having a Super Bowl party. Who's playing?
Anyways, thank you for coming. That was God and Science.
You guys ask good questions.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
What's the first book you wrote?
The first one?
Yeah.
Is There a God?
Well, that's the first one?
Yeah.
Really good.
Do you want the book?
Straight to the table.
If you want a book, let us know. We do Venmo, we do Square, we actually take...
How much is your first book?
My dad?
Like $12.
Oh, straight up?
Yeah.
Welcome, man. Hi, how are you doing? Caleb, wait.
I'm saying, Caleb, nice to meet you.
Stop living by faith.